I'm Adam Clivens. This is the IFML podcast. IFML is the Institute for Foundations of Machine Learning. We are a NSF National AI Institute headquartered at the University of Texas at Austin. And I'm here with my friend and colleague, Alex Demakis, and our UW, University of Washington, alumni and colleagues. Today, we're going to be talking about generative AI, but more so from an evaluative perspective. How do we evaluate sort of text and images that all of these new models are generating? And how does it relate to foundational ideas? That's what we do at IFML. Krishna, you want to set the stage for us here?
I'm Krishna Pilotla. I'm an alumnus of the University of Washington and IFML. I'm currently a visiting researcher at Google Research.
And I'm John Thixton. I finished my PhD at UW in 2021, and I'm currently a postdoc at Stanford working broadly on generative models.
I am Zaid Arshawi. I'm a principal investigator of the Institute for Foundations of Machine Learning. I am a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle in statistics and computer science and engineering.
Great. Thanks, guys. So Krishna, set the stage for us here. Tell us about MOV and some of the new techniques that you guys have for evaluating generative AI models.
Yeah. So MOV is a measure of the gap between two distributions. So the distribution of text generated by the model and the distribution of real-world text or images that we are trying to model. So for instance, if we have a generative text model like ChatGPT that can produce a bunch of text, what we have is a way of measuring how far the distribution of the text produced by ChatGPT is from what humans would write.
So what does that mean? How do you even model the distribution of what text that humans write looks like?
So we're assuming that there is some distribution that overall human-written text in the world, and whatever data we collect from human evaluators or from existing data sets are samples from this particular distribution.
How are you guys collecting data on what human written text looks like? Is that just scouring the internet or?
Yeah, there are existing data sets that range from just text scraped off the internet to more curated data sets that are collected, say, for instance, novel that are in the open.
One problem that we have in generating images, like when we were evaluating GANs or other image generative models, is that the model can essentially memorize a few images, right? So there was an issue about the images looking very good, but they were memorized. And in the generating images space, there was a lot of trade-off between high quality measurements versus diversity measurements. And I don't know much about how text quality is evaluated beyond perplexity, but can you tell us a little bit about how your metric is different?
So there is a certain quality diversity trade-off in text as well. What we are doing is we are actually just measuring some sort of a distance between the distributions. So if you're in a situation where the model just memorizes a few images, then distance between the distribution it produces, which is some set of memorized images, to some unseen set of real images that we want to model will be large. So the gap will be large if the generative model lacks diversity. And the gap will also be large if the generative model produces poor quality images or text. The gap that MOV measures will be small if the generative model produces images or text that are both high quality and can capture the diversity of the real world samples that we are comparing to.
One advantage of an automatic metric like MOV is that it can really get at these diversity questions in ways that it's very difficult for humans to do. It's very natural to ask a human to look at a collection of samples from a generative model and ask them about the quality of these samples, or for text, ask them about the fluency of the generated text or the grammaticality. And humans are very good at determining sort of the quality of generated samples. But it's actually a very difficult question for humans to look at a large collection of samples from a model and answer questions about the diversity of these samples. It's just difficult for a person to look at 10,000 pieces of generative content just in terms of time and keeping them in their memory to think about the spread of these examples. And one thing that we're very excited about for automatic evaluation metrics, including MOV, is that we can really get at some of these questions of the diversity of the generative models. So you mentioned GANs and how GANs can potentially sacrifice diversity for quality, and metrics like MOV are a way to measure that sacrifice.
Building more on that, the one issue we have seen in images is there are metrics that need ground truth in addition to the generated distribution. And there are some other metrics that only work with generated data, like inception score versus FID are the metrics in image generation. To understand a little the landscape for language models, which metrics need ground truth and which metrics can be evaluated just from generated text?
MOV needs some samples from the two distributions that we are comparing. In this case, that's the generative model and the ground truth. So we do need samples from ground truth. On the other hand, there are other measures like perplexity that only look at samples from the real world. So validation data, for instance.
Have traditionally people measured the diversity of text in NLP? And how have researchers in NLP traditionally gathered various text sources to train on? What has traditionally been the method to ensure diversity? What types of corpora are they looking at?
So I think by default, the methods that we use to train models in NLP are less susceptible to this diversity sacrifice than the GAN models that we saw for a while in Vision, because they're trained to minimize perplexity or to minimize the cross entropy, whereas the GANs are this more greedy metric for improving quality. But that said, once you train up one of these models, it's very common in NLP to apply a post-processing step at inference time where you run some sort of truncation sampler or nucleus sampler. These post-processing steps very explicitly and deliberately sacrifice diversity to try to produce higher quality samples from the model. So you really start to get these effects of diminished diversity at inference time from these models. And we're also starting to see at a more of the training stage now with these models that are trained with RLHF, reinforcement learning with human feedback, that in a similar way, these models or these training procedures that now take a generic generative model and try to shape it to fit some human preference also tend to exhibit this behavior where the quality of the outputs goes up, but the diversity of the outputs goes down.
So just to chime in, in GANs, the biggest problem we had compared to NLP was that the GAN doesn't give you a likelihood, right? It's a box, you put in some random numbers, it spits out some pixels, but you cannot give it some pixels and it gives you a number of the likelihood of that image. Whereas you guys in NLP have these autoregressive models that can compute likelihoods. So the first natural thing that you would think coming into NLP would be it's giving you the likelihood of data, the perplexity, as you call it. So that would be the perfect metric to train and the perfect metric to evaluate naively. Now, there's a second issue that you mentioned that during sampling, you're not just sampling one word at a time, but rather you have all these complicated sampling methods that I don't know anything about. But I understand there's, again, a trade-off between how creative the model is versus how realistic and diverse and so on. But can you dive again into what is the problem with using perplexity or the likelihood of the data as a metric for evaluation?
One thing about the language is that it's multifaceted. So when a human reads a text, be it human or artificial, there are all kinds of perceptions of like how much the text can look like realistic or well written and so on. And when we talk about evaluating a text, we may mean many things by that. We may mean that the text is well written. It may mean that the text is rich in content. It may mean that the text is not too repetitive. It may mean that the text is too short, too long, and all kinds of things like that. And in natural language processing, there are various tasks that's been defined. For instance, question answering, summarization, translation, and so on. And so for each of those tasks, the language that was produced has been evaluated with what we call metrics or measures. So those are numbers that allow to compare models in terms of how well they're performing according to those very specific metrics.
Good. So you have different metrics, whether it's question and answering versus summarization. Well,
what's been happening over the last few years is that the progress in natural language processing, machine learning, and artificial intelligence in general has been like much faster than expected, at least for many. And we found ourselves short of quantitative measures to basically give quantitative assessments of how well this model does these particular tasks. And in natural language processing, there's been a tradition of defining metrics or measures for each specific task. And popular ones go by names that are associated to colors, rouge, blue, and so forth and so on. And when the GPT models and other models were proposed, basically they were looked at through the lens of those measures, but the richness of the text that was produced and all the facets of the test that was produced and all the things that human could see on how this model may be better than this model at this particular task were not captured by the existing. And while there were several of them, it was insufficient to basically describe and capture with numbers why is this model better than this other one.
How did people figure that out? Were you looking at text that was generated by GPT-2 and realizing this is just way better summarization than we've ever seen before, but the metrics just weren't increasing that much? Is that what was going on? Or why were these? See, that was actually happening. It was just an eye test. You're looking at this text. It's just way better than what we've seen before, but yet the metrics were flatlined.
Right. Traditionally, when machine learning model is developed, this model is trained, that is set to minimize some criterion or maximize some criterion to do better according to this measure. And so most metrics have been associated to that specific objective that the model was trained to do well at. And so perplexity, for instance, is very closely tied to the specific objective, that optimization objective that large language models are trained to. But the thing is that those models are trained in a very non-smooth way.
Which models? You're talking about GPT?
Large language models are not models that are trained in a very straightforward way. So like the path to get them to a good value of the objective is not a smooth path. It's reset, reboot, and so forth and so on. And it requires a lot of what people call training babysitting. And so as a result, we need other quantitative measures to measure how to capture why this model is doing well at its particular objective, it's also doing well in other terms, but also why maybe not doing well in some particular aspects. Basically, the point is that large language models that are good for specific tasks, this is captured by multiple metrics or measures. And it's very hard from an optimization viewpoint to optimize several metrics at the same time. It's actually very hard to train those models, even to optimize a single objective at one time. That's where this project started. The fact that the main researchers in natural language processing and engineers were seeing text that to humans in a subjective manner seemed better and better at particular task, but the existing metrics did not capture why they were doing better or why they were doing worse. And so MOV came as a proposal to add another lens to stare at text that is produced by language models and try to capture with a number why they are doing better in some ways and some others. Of course, it's not capturing all aspects in which those language models are better than doing better than models, but it's capturing some specific aspects that were not captured by previous existing metrics.
One more thing to say along those lines is the importance of these metrics in publishing, right? In our scientific research, as you all know, it's important to perform well in the metrics that the community has decided are the important ones. And in generating images, I must say, when I first heard of inception score and FID as metrics of evaluating the quality of generated images, I was shocked by how naive they sounded. But I must say that FID, even though it sounds like a very wrong thing to do, it's supposed to be a distance between images, but it's very difficult to compute distances between high-dimensional distributions. So it's doing a few things that are very naive, in my opinion. But still, it is true that we saw that when the model was indeed producing better images, FID score was better, was lower. So a metric like ImageNet accuracy or FID score or MOV, I think matters when progress in the metric reflects progress in the real science, right? Or in the real quality of the generated data. And I guess what we have to understand is then you have to convince the society or the community that this is actually a useful metric. And by you publishing in NeurIPS and winning the Best Paper Award, that established your metric as now a metric that everybody will accept as a measure of progress. I don't know if you have seen that or what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so I can speak a little bit to this because I've now been working with several groups and talking with people who are using MOV to evaluate their models in work that I'm not even involved in, just chatting with them. And researchers have felt that MOV is an incredibly useful tool, especially for preliminary investigations of the quality of models. So it's a number that you can check and iterate on to very quickly make progress in developing your systems without relying on some of these more expensive and time-consuming studies where you go out to people and present the final outputs of your final system to them. So it can be an engine, as we've seen for vision as well, for fast progress, where you can iterate quickly using automated metrics to judge the quality of your systems.
It seems like there was a hodgepodge of metrics out there evaluating text. And the point of MOV is to come up with just a slew of better metrics to help us understand progress that's being made. But I want to push you guys a little bit more on a description of what MOV is. Does it take all of the previous metrics and include them into some one ensembling of metrics? Are there brand new metrics? Are they more quantitative? Tell us more about how MOV works. It's some function that takes in text and spits out a number, but tell us a little bit more about what goes into that.
So maybe I can add a little bit of context here as well on the type of tasks that were considered previously. As Zahid mentioned, a lot of tasks in NLP were very specific, translation and so on. The tasks that were considered changed as the quality of the models improved. Come 2018, we had models that could generate multiple paragraphs of text of pretty high quality in response to prompts of the form, write an essay about, I don't know, the weather in Seattle.
So this was pre-ChatGPT. This was 2018.
Yes. GPT-2, for example, was a big turning point. So even 2 years before that, in 2016, the de facto task in, let's say, generating stories was given 3 sentences, complete the fourth sentence. And that was usually, that was the models that we had were at that point were only able to produce 1 sentence, and after that things would just go off the rails. And in 2018, suddenly we had a model, GPT-2, that could produce multiple paragraphs of incredibly high quality text. At that point, people got interested in a task called open-ended generation, where there's no target, the model just has to write about something. And this is in contrast to tasks like translation or question answering, where what the model responds to is very directed. And because there in let's say in 2019 or 2020, which is when we started thinking about these problems, open-ended generation was very new. So it was not widespread. There was a very small group of people around the world who were even interested in this problem.
So there were effectively no metrics for evaluating open-ended generation. Is that right?
Exactly. So what folks were doing were to reuse and repurpose some of the older ones that were not exactly working as intended. They were giving some measure on how good a language model is. Perplexity, for example, which was one that came up. It's just measuring the cross entropy, right? The loss, just predicting the next word. Is when we actually generate a text, we'd apply some sort of a post-processing, truncating some options and then iterating, right, multiple steps. So we sample one word at a time. And by iterating, so Perplexity only measures what happens one word at a time. But when actually generating, now with open-ended generation, we'd want to measure several paragraphs. So there was a gap and people were just using the previous ones while acknowledging that they were not perfect and saying that, okay, this is giving us some signal, it's not perfect, so let's also conduct a human study. For a few years since open-ended generation came up, human evaluations were the gold standard. Every time someone wanted to say, I have a new post-processing or a decoding algorithm, as it's called, one had to run a large human study in order to actually establish that it was better than the usual previous way of doing things.
So for every paper that was coming out, you had a human study to analyze how good the text was. Is that right?
That is right.
So to understand this, one more question. Let's say I'm sticking to Perplexity, right? And to evaluate a generative model that produces free stories, free text, I would need to compute its perplexity on some other text, like Harry Potter or something. So what is what you're saying that if I was sticking to Harry Potter perplexity, there was easy ways to essentially hack the model to get very good perplexities, but the model not being good? Was that the problem with Perplexity?
That is a problem with Perplexity. There are several ways Perplexity can be hacked, but here are two simple ones. So Perplexity is just basically measuring the average cross entropy over the entire sequence. And you can say, oh, let me have a few, like half the text is extremely low cross entropy and the other half is extremely high. And the resulting text can be completely gibberish, but Perplexity or cross entropy will still think it has the right value.
That's because Perplexity is measuring some local quantity of the output.
Yeah, local quantity averaged over an entire sequence.
Right, so it's not capturing sort of long-range coherence of the text.
Exactly, that's right. So Perplexity or cross-entropy are very good for measuring how good a language model is at the task of language modeling. That is to say, how good it can guess the single next word. Whereas when we actually use them in practice, we use them to generate, in this case that we are interested in, several hundreds of words. So really there's a mismatch and one can game Perplexity by just using that mismatch.
So were there some natural methods to try and extend Perplexity to make it more coherent over a longer scale?
So that is something that we thought about. Really, what would a distinguishing factor between, say, text that is written by models and text that's written by humans is how it is in human text, there is an occasional surprising word that comes up to keep it interesting. And that does not happen in model text. So really, we'd want to look at how the cross entropy changes per token. And that is also a really hard problem because now we are comparing time series and we're trying to look at how good is this time series when compared to the other one. And in some sense, it's just as hard as trying to evaluate the generative model itself.
Basically, in 2018, these models are coming out, Perplexity-based scores. It's obvious to everyone they don't make sense. You're relying on all of these human studies to evaluate the text that's being generated. That's when you started thinking about the different metrics. That's the origin of MOV. Or how did, you know, what were the interesting insights that you had trying to come up with these new metrics? What were some exciting breakthroughs? How did it come together?
So AI is marked by several waves of probably the introduction of new architectures and new training approaches and new ways to collect data. In 2017, a new type of architecture was introduced, transformer models that are based on a particular kind of basic module that's called an attention layer. And that architecture is actually simple in its design in that it's repeating the same kind of module or computing module over and over at a very large scale. And at the same time, people or like many labs have started to train such models at a very large scale with huge amounts of computing resources in particular using GPUs and TPUs. And with that came a new generation of what people call language models that generate text, and they date back to 20 years before, or even the work of Shannon or Markov. And with those models, like, people started to look at the text, use them for many tasks. And when people ran multiple metrics on them, they would see that this model is particularly better according to what humans would say when they evaluate them, but no number would capture that. And so as part of IFML, multidisciplinary work has been encouraged, in particular, trying to combine insights from more theory and applications. And so this came about by research discussions that we had early on with a natural language processing team that is at University of Washington and led by Yejin Choi. And she has another team also at the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. And the starting point of the conversation was that those very large models that they were experimenting with were doing much better according to humans than others. But there was no metric, none of the colored metrics that exist in NLP, blue, rouge, those ones, seem to either apply or capture those. And we're trying to define a mathematical quantity or statistical quantity that can be computed, that can be executed, and rather quickly, that would capture what those models were doing better at. The idea was that to do something that would be different than existing metrics, which were like city and so on, very closely related to the objective that those models were trying to optimize.
And computationally, Zaid, what's the, let's say I have my GPT-7, I'm training in my basement and I want to evaluate MOV, and you have an open source tool that I can just feed it generated text and it will give me a number, or does it also need ground truth data?
As part of this project, it's very important to develop code that is open source. And the code for MOV has been developed in several stages. First, as a research code that has been submitted along with the paper when we submitted it to NeurIPS, a leading machine learning and AI conference. But as a second stage, it was also deployed on a popular open source library, Hugging Face. And this, the outreach of that is huge. So it touches most of the community of practitioners in AI and also researchers in AI.
Yeah. So we asked for samples from your generative model and some samples from the target distribution you want to compare to. And the software package can just return a number from that point on. The number of samples that we'd want ideally is at least a few thousands. And with, let's say, 5,000 samples each, it runs in about 3 minutes on my laptop.
Okay, great. Because in GANs, when we run FID, it's actually a huge pain to compute FID. We need to generate 50,000 images. And we think a significant part of the generative model research goes in actually computing FID for a gazillion hyperparameter configurations, of course. So the speed of evaluation is a huge part of our day-to-day GPU expenditures.
I mentioned that previously the kinds of natural language tasks that people considered were very limited in scope compared to, say, generating several hundred words, right? Very directed, very one sentence at a time type of a thing. Let's say we want to run some translation tasks. We want to produce something in the target which that is similar to some literal translation that a human would give. So the kinds of things that were very prevalent in the community were looking at how similar in terms of overlap is the generated text to, let's say, what a human would give. Now, once we start talking about the open-ended setting, that no longer makes sense because there are so many different ways in which one can plausibly respond to a given prompt and still be quote-unquote correct. There's no really one correct way of responding. We just want it to make sense.
Sure.
So the biggest insight we had was to think of it as maybe looking at how good is the distribution of whatever is generated by the model compared to something that humans would write on aggregate, not on a case-by-case basis, but on aggregate.
So what does that mean on aggregate? You're giving it various prompts, then you're looking at how well it does across or various types of different tasks or?
Yeah, so we give it various prompts. On a prompt by prompt basis, the model might respond differently to humans. But on average, we want it to have the same characteristics that a human response would. It's grammatical and it makes sense and so on. So where theory comes into the picture is to formalize all of this as measuring the distance between two distributions, one produced by the model and one, let's say, that humans would give.
Okay, and what statistical, these sound like some kind of statistical concepts. Were there other tools from statistics or optimization that came into play here?
Yes. So essentially, we started off by considering information divergences and looking at how an information divergence between these two distributions would look like. And immediately we run into an issue of computation. So all of these distributions that we have now, let's say text or images, are very complex, high dimensional. It's not clear how to estimate any of those using, let's say, a few thousand samples, which is what we might have realistically in the real world. So that's
For images, we have way more than 1,000 samples, so we could compute information divergences.
A few tens of thousands, but that is still much smaller than the space of all possible images that can be produced by a model. Like even assuming that each pixel can take 255 values and then there are some number of pixels, the space of all possible images is extremely large, and that's the same with the text. There's no way we can generate enough samples to have coverage over this entire distribution. So that's where theoretical insights entered the picture. So how do we actually, and it's a natural idea to measure information divergences, but how do we actually do that in practice?
And that hadn't been tackled before on some other types of learning tasks, or?
It's been studied in theory, like estimating information divergences has a long and rich history, dating back to at least the 60s and 70s. But actually putting that into practice on these large-scale text models, I think, hadn't really been tackled previously.
And what's the advantage of looking at information divergences versus, say, perplexity?
Because we are getting this bird's-eye sort of distributional view of what's going on. So perplexity is basically looking at what's happening locally, right? How are we doing for the single next word? It's not measuring, it can't measure if things go off rails gradually, little by little.
Yeah. Also, from a very practical perspective, coming out of this collaboration with Yejin's group, Yejin and her students have been at the forefront of developing these truncation sampling methods, in particular, this nucleus sampling method that is a post-processing technique that you apply to these generative language models at inference time to be more conservative about the outputs of these models.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that? Sort of what is this nucleus?
Yeah, so what nucleus sampling says is every time, so how these generative models of language works is they predict one token at a time, and every token in the sequence, you look at the history of the sequence, and then the model defines a probability distribution over what word might come next. And what a truncation sampler, like the nucleus sampler does, is say, don't just sample from this probability distribution. Only sample from the head of the probability distribution. So don't consider any words that the model thinks has low probability. And what this does is it makes the model more conservative in what it outputs. So it's not going to occasionally output a rare word. It's always going to be very conservative and predictable in what it outputs. And this tends to, what this does is it tends to keep the model on the rails. If you're not doing this, the model can potentially start to spit out weird things, and then it conditions on these weird things and it spins out even weirder things. And then you get these incoherent long-term generations, even though the perplexity of the next word token of the model seems okay. And nucleus sampling corrects for that and says, let's be really conservative about what we do so we don't get into these bad states. But a consequence of that is that you now can't get this model's perplexity, because if you have a test set where the next word that appears in the sequence is discarded by the nucleus sampler, now the model is assigning zero probability to this continuation. And so if you calculate a perplexity, the perplexity is infinity. And so it was not clear at the time, but before the MOV work, how to properly evaluate, or really any way to effectively evaluate these language models as they were used in practice with these nucleus sampling and truncation sampling techniques.
So to understand this a little better, and given that I don't know how different sampling or decoding techniques work in NLP, I understand the GPT model takes the previous words and gives you the distribution for the next word or the next token. Now, I could be sampling from that distribution one word at a time, as you said. And the other thing that I suppose I could be doing is I can have a temperature that says, okay, I'm not going to actually sample from the distribution of the next word given the previous ones, but I'm going to increase the probability of the high probability words, right? So the extreme of that would be greedy, selecting deterministically the highest probability word coming out of the GPT probability model. What I'm not getting is, what's the problem with doing that, setting a temperature, compared to the more complicated decoding or nucleus sampling techniques that you described?
Yeah, so I suppose this is really an empirical question, and there's been extensive documentation in the empirical NLP literature that shows that these truncation sampling techniques are much more effective than temperature sampling. I don't personally have strong intuitions for why that would be, but
they just happen to work better. They just work better. And yeah.
I think, all right, if I stretched for an intuition, temperature sampling makes a really global change to the probability distribution over the next token in the sequence. And I think the intuition of nucleus sampling is that, look, your probability statistics for the head of the distribution are probably pretty good. That's right. You have, thinking about this as just like maybe a count statistics kind of problem. You generally, for the head of your distribution, count statistics have good confidence intervals around your predictions of the high probability objects. But down in the tail of the distribution, your probabilities may be very miscalibrated. And so nucleus sampling says, look, let's just sample from the head of the distribution where we know we have good estimates, and ignore the tail of the distribution.
I see. And another related thing we teach is, sometimes we teach Viterbi decoding or beam searching methods, which are essentially, instead of just keeping the highest word or sampling one word with high probability, let's keep a few options open, because maybe three words down the line, some very high probability completion shows up, right? So in the landscape of all these sampling methods, is beam searching or Viterbi type of algorithms ever used?
Let me chip in. So I think one thing to keep in mind with language models is that we talk about probability of this, probability of that, probability of the next token, and so forth and so on. But when we do, we take a lot of liberty with the term probability. There has been a period of time where in natural language processing, the most successful models were proper probabilistic models. And that's why, like, the scores that would come out of those models would indeed be probabilities. I'm talking about like Markov models, hidden Markov models, conditional random fields, and so on. But with the current large language models, the models are not normalized, in that they are not, it's not straightforward to associate a proper probabilistic model to them. And so when we talk about the probabilities, it's a shortcut or even like an abuse, because those scores are not really calibrated in order to be probabilities. And to me, at least, that's why things, when we say Viterbi and so on, like all those families of algorithms are well understood when they are applied to proper, normalized, calibrated probabilistic models. But when they are applied to other models that are related to probabilistic models, but not really probabilistic models, many of our intuitions, they fall short. And that might be what's going on here.
I see. And on the calibration issue, can you maybe explain a little bit what is the problem of miscalibrated probabilities and how would we measure it?
Right. So like what we call a probability is the limit object if we were to repeat an experiment many times, and we would compute the frequency of particular events, and we will look whether this frequency converges to some limit if we perform a large number of experiments. And so we predict the next token, we would like to do this kind of asymptotics. And for that score, that is, that outcomes the language model to be interpreted as something that is related to some frequency, we need to sum over all possible sequences and so forth and so on. And this is, for most purposes, like in most situations, completely intractable for large language models. So the reason why they don't do this is because at that scale, it simply is not feasible to design a probabilistic model. It's an impediment, in fact. But then the price we pay is that the scores are not really probabilities. That's also something that bites us when we generate long pieces of text. Many of the issues we face are related to the fact that those are not properly normalized probabilistic models. I'm not saying that those models are better. I'm just saying that those are models for intuition. We use the term probability, but it can be misleading, and also we lose some nice interpretations when doing so.
Yeah. And one more question on this, on the lines of sampling methods that you're explaining to us how critical they are. Do you know if the state-of-the-art models like GPT-4 and Bard and the models that are deployed out there today, do you know if they use sophisticated sampling methods and what methods are used?
So we have very little insight actually into many of these most recent models. If you look at the GPT-4 paper, it's actually very explicit that they say nothing about the methods that they're running. And in fact, you'll see even now, a lot of these services that, for example, OpenAI provides, that used to provide the probabilities or pseudo probabilities of next tokens in the sequence, they're now either fuzzing those numbers, so adding noise to them so you don't know exactly what the probabilities were, or just reporting the like top 20 or top 50 probabilities, so you don't see the tail of the distribution. And they're doing this to protect their model so that people can't steal it, but it also makes it very difficult as an independent researcher to inspect these models and understand how they're actually behaving. So I would say it seems likely that these models are being sampled with some of these truncation and adjusted sampling methods, but we have very little insight into the latest systems and what exactly they're doing.
But we know that nucleus sampling, for example, has been used in production?
We do not know that. But we do know that like NLP teams who are producing models that, all things considered, when put on a relative scale, perform somewhat on par with models that OpenAI would release. We do know that they would use something similar. One connection we can make that may be helpful here is that there is another area of AI that has experienced similar challenges, and in which there's been also like tremendous progress. And this is speech recognition and speech transcription. And over the last 10 years, decoding algorithms for speech have also gone very wild and departed from, say, like the traditional school of thought using related to dynamic programming and so on. And it's hard to see any consistency in which method wins over time in all the benchmarks. But I think a common thread is that the methods that become the yield state-of-the-art results have more parameters that can be tuned. So if I had to bet, I would say that the decoding algorithm of those latest models have some parameters, and then they were tuned to perform well.
Very good. One more question that came up from, you mentioned model stealing or running distillation on models that are hosted by APIs. I just want to bring the conversation a little bit on this matter. So as many of, there was this trend of DALL-E or GPT-3 and so on being behind an API, but it is possible to ask multiple queries to those foundation models, effectively create a new training set, and then fine-tune your own model using this new training set to get performance that sometimes seems to be getting close to the proprietary hidden model, right? So this was demonstrated famously as Llama, which was an open model, was converted into Alpaca by creating, as far as I understood, a training data set by querying an OpenAI model behind an API. And I'm curious what in the space of distillation and creating modes and preventing model stealing, I don't know what your thoughts are in the future of large language models in relation to these issues of being able to distill models and how things will play out in this space.
Why is it called model stealing? It's fair game. You're using these models to label your own data sets to come up with your own models. Distillation, I understand, but why is it called stealing?
It's, I guess, stealing the way I have no moral judgment on that issue. But the idea is that OpenAI could be spending infinitely more money to do this instruction tuning by getting human experts. And then you can just perform a few thousand queries on that model, pay $400, as Stanford famously paid, and get something comparable to that. So I wouldn't call it stealing, but if you're spending $1 million to do something and then I can do the same thing spending $400, you won't be very happy with that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I think I introduced the word stealing to the conversation, and that's certainly a very corporate perspective on what's going on here, and I don't necessarily ascribe to that view.
Right, but beyond the word, I think this is a huge topic, so I would love to get your opinions about, do you think this will be happening a lot? Many people use the word moat, right, for startups, saying that, oh, my moat, the other companies cannot compete is because I have all this data that I spend millions of dollars collecting. So if it is possible to essentially get that benefit by querying the model through an API a few thousand times, maybe there is no moat, right? So that's what I would love to get your thoughts on.
So I think, there are several aspects to this. The first one is like a high-level one, which is that in any industry, it's often easier to look at an existing product and just work at reducing the costs of developing that product while not spending anything on innovation, rather than taking a big bet and innovating and producing the first version of such a product. So that existed in the car industry, aerobics, everywhere for a long time. So I think there's aspect to it, right? And I think in AI, there's not only like the collection of data, the model design, but also designing compressed models and like there's over optimizing the training algorithm and so forth and so on. So there are all kinds of aspects where there are currently startups that are taking the training of large models and cutting down the training time by a factor of 5 or 10 and so on, based on like the checkpoints of other teams that have developed new models, right? So I think this is the high level aspect. But then like at a very technical aspect, there is also this like a very striking phenomenon that of distillation, right? Which is that when you distill a model, it sounds like many things become easier. And that is like a scientific topic, which so far I don't think anyone has really understood. And it's an interesting topic.
Sorry, go ahead. Did you want to say something, John?
I would also just say that my perspective on these distillations from an academic perspective is that I think that this points to a lot of potential for academia to continue to be relevant and have a strong voice in the conversations going forward. What may be bad news for OpenAI in terms of being able to protect their capital investments in these models is potentially good news for academia, and that it seems like we may be able to reproduce and study these models, or at least versions and reflections of these models, ourselves in an academic environment, and that maybe this technology won't get locked up and hidden away behind corporate actors.
So as an NLP researcher, going on that a little bit more, I know that a lot of papers now are, I run these queries in the OpenAI API. What do you see the role of academia to be? And what type of questions would you ask for, OpenAI, can you at the very least tell me what model I'm running, or can you give me a frozen version or something? Like, do you have very concrete ideas or suggestions about how to make academic research still remain relevant without the massive resources? And what questions would academics will continue to be studying to stay relevant, in your opinion?
So it seems to me that there are two directions for academic research, right? One is to treat this model that a corporate lab has produced as an artifact and perform science on this artifact. And for that, yes, you definitely would like to have some amount of reproducibility and pegged versioning and be able to confirm that the model that you're experimenting with in 2024 is the same model that you're experimenting with in 2023. And we've certainly seen issues with this already. Like we saw this this Sparks paper out of Microsoft Research operating on an early version of GPT-4 that nobody actually has access to. And it's a little hard to call this paper a scientific contribution if nobody else can reproduce its results. And I'm optimistic that maybe these are growing pains and we'll be able to get a versioning of these generative models in the same way that corporations are able to produce versioned releases of any other software product they provide. So that's one direction. And I think we need to push these companies to be a little more disciplined about their release strategies. On the other side, it does seem to me that there's enormous potential to continue to contribute to fundamental scientific research on these models. For example, MOV, which didn't require or involve any large-scale training and capital investments to be able to develop and run. And there continue to be serious challenges to these models that are not at all clear can be solved at scale. So for example, right now, there's a lot of interest in the truthfulness of these models. People are, this is obvious to many researchers in the field, but the general public is waking up to the fact that these generative models, by their nature, hallucinate. And it can provide you a very fluent and convincing and coherently presented answer to some question that is completely false. And this is somewhat in the nature of these generative models. And it's not clear that the current training and scaling regime has any solution to these problems. And we need fundamental research to figure out how to make these models more truthful and more consistent with themselves. There's also interpretability questions, for example, of which metrics and benchmarks are also vital for understanding how these models behave and why they're producing the answers that they do. And that's also a question that seems not answerable simply by scale. I think there's a variety of these questions about how these models behave, how to construct better models that are more suitable and perhaps aligned to our interests and what we want from them, that I'm very excited by. And I think the fact that we are able to scale these models up once we have the right ideas is just a sign that we really should continue to work on the fundamental research in these areas to continue to build models that perform better and are more suitable to our needs once we do scale them.
So let me ask a little bit more about MOV. How did you guys know when your team was onto something, when it was really starting to work well? Was there an aha moment, or are you just seeing metrics that just made more sense? Tell us about the iterative process behind that.
Yeah. So one example of this is that it had been common knowledge in the field for several years at that point that these models tended to fall apart over longer term generations. So if you generated 100 words or tokens from one of these models, maybe they looked really good. But if you generated 1,000 tokens from this model, towards the end, the generation quality started to fall apart.
Even for GPT-2 or?
Even for GPT-2. Now, some of the more recent models like GPT-3 and GPT-4 are strikingly capable of producing coherent long-term structures. And certainly even for GPT-2, especially if you were willing to cherry pick, you could sometimes get content that was coherent over the long term. But on average, generation quality did tend to fall apart over longer and longer sequences. And the fact that this happened was not well captured in any of the existing metrics. And we started to produce these curves using MOV, where you looked at the MOV score of generations over varying different numbers of tokens, and you saw these clear trends where as you sampled longer and longer sequences from these models, the MOV score of the subsequent resulting generations trended further and further down. And this was very reflective of the human evaluation of these models. And it was very exciting to see that this was captured by this quantitative metric in a way that hadn't really been properly captured by quantitative metrics before.
What kind of evaluations did you do to test that MOV was working well with regards to human studies? Did you do extensive human studies and testing to verify that MOV was really calibrated right? Or
yeah, that's a great question. So in our development cycles, we looked at all of these trends, right, over the generation length, over model size, and so on. And we tried to look for methods that gave us the right trends. And once we were happy with what we had, we actually ran a large-scale human study. And we asked our human evaluators, we showed them text produced by two different models or a model and compared to human text, and we asked them which one was better, right? Which one looked more human-like. And we used a statistical model to build a ranking of human preference, human evaluator preference for these models. And we looked at the ranking that MOV produced, and we compared the two rankings.
And they're pretty close, or?
They're super close, yes.
So I think one thing that is really shocking in the recent progress of AI and machine learning is the debauchery of computing resources and data that is happening in order to train those models. And this is out of tune in a moment of history where we all need to pay more attention to climate change and the resources we use for technological advances. And certainly there's a lot of room for improvement to develop more frugal models that can do as well with much less data and can do as well with much less computing resources. And so I think that's a very interesting direction. And another way is in relation to MOV, I think an interesting topic of research is that whenever a natural language processing model is deployed, we need to perform human evaluation, right? And currently, like even OpenAI has scaled that up. They have this thing called iterative deployments where they do human evaluation very frequently as they improve their model. This is obviously super expensive, right? Because all those human evaluators are trained and paid and so on.
Right.
And also time consuming. And we need better ways to make a better use of the time of human evaluators, or possibly in many situations, try to not need human evaluation in order to make progress with those models. And it's unclear how, but I think it's a very interesting research. But I would say, like, overall, I think one interesting topic of research at a high level in AI and machine learning is just to do better with less. And this is somewhat the minority topic right now, as everyone is scaling up, using more resources, using more data, using more humans in order to make progress.
Isn't the hope of MOV that we can get rid of human studies for how good the text looks? Or
no, it wasn't. I'm just saying there is a human in the loop that we used and most people use right now. And I think it would be interesting to try to have proxies to human evaluations, or maybe think better how to design human evaluations in order to get this information.
John, Krishna, do you want to talk about some future work?
Yeah, so one direction that I'm excited to think about is that, so when we developed MOV, we were very much thinking about it as a tool for researchers and for science and for evaluating the models that we're building. But as these models become more impactful and increasingly deployed in products and in society, we're starting to see new socio-technical questions where generated text is starting to appear in the wild and people are worried about misinformation and propaganda. And so increasingly, one direction that people are very interested in is whether we can detect that it's been generated by models in the wild. And one way to think about MOV is that it's essentially a detector for machine-generated text that you could potentially run on some arbitrary text that you've been given and ask whether it's generated by a model. And there's increasing work in this direction, DetectGPT and such, that are trying to be able to identify machine-generated text in the wild. And I think this is a important social technical question. And I think that tools like MOV and further developments in this direction are potentially tools that we can leverage to help provide defense against the flood of machine-generated text.
Yeah, right out of the box, how well does MOV work at detecting GPT-3 or 4 generated output?
So one challenge here when you're thinking about this at the social technical level is that usually, like when you want to identify machine-generated text in the wild, you have like a particular example that you want to query and ask, is this machine-generated? And MOV out of the box requires like 5,000 examples to be able to compare this distribution of text to the human distribution of text.
I see. So on an individual example level, it's difficult for it.
It's not really possible. And MOV wasn't really designed to do that. But I do think that metrics that seek to compare machine-generated text to human-generated text and pick up on subtle distinctions between the distributions of these two generation processes are important going forward. MOV was maybe an early step in this direction, particularly like work on instance level detection can be very important going forward.
So it needs 5,000 samples of text, let's say 5,000 sentences or 5,000 paragraphs. And the second question is, does it also need reference text that we know is not AI generated?
That's right. You need 5,000 samples. So the protocol that we developed, and obviously there's protocol and you could push this, and this is another interesting question, is could you do this with fewer samples? But the way we set up MOV, you compare 5,000 samples of machine-generated text to 5,000 samples of your reference distribution of human-generated text. So you need both of these collections of data to run MOV.
And a sample is a sentence or a paragraph or a page?
So it depends on how you set up the problem. Like you could run MOV on just like a sentence and compare sentences of machine-generated text to human text, or you could run it on paragraphs. The point is that you need to be comparing apples to apples. So if you're comparing single sentences, then you compare single sentences. If you compare paragraphs of machine-generated text, you compare it to paragraphs of human text. But we do see, getting back to the earlier discussion, that it becomes easier to detect this divergence between distributions at longer generation lengths. So for example, if you just have a sentence, single sentences of text, it seems unlikely with the most recent generations of generative models that MOV would be able to notice any distinction between a single sentence of machine-generated text and, or even like a distribution over single sentences of machine-generated text and the distribution over human sentences of text.
Can you pick kind of one cool theoretical insight that you think is really exciting?
Yeah, so in the version of MOV that is currently in Hugging Face, we use a vector quantization using k-means. In the theoretical analysis, we do use the fact that this kind of data-driven approximation of the probability metric is used. And so in the theoretical paper, we have theoretical grounding for this kind of approximation. And another thing is that when we deal with text, there's always the fact that the sample of text is not necessarily representative of all kinds of text that may occur in human text. And there are some corrections that can be used. And those are often referred to as like smoothing corrections or like a good Turing or Laplace smoothing correction. And in the latest paper on MOV we have put out on archive recently, we do compare various smoothing techniques, show that they can make MOV more robust when it's applied in real domains.
Awesome.
No, that's great.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
That was great, guys. Thanks for being here.